Welcome to Women Over 70, Aging Reimagined, and dedicated to silencing the chatter about what women should and shouldn't be doing as they age. Here to bring you stories about women in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, women who are leading inspiring lives that make a difference to themselves and others, are Catherine Marino and Gail Zelitsky.
Hi, I'm Catherine.
And I'm Gail, and we are the active voice of Women Over 70, Aging Reimagined. Welcome to our weekly podcast. Please visit our website, womenover70.com, where you can download the playlist of all the episodes. We also invite you to join our podcast discussion club, and we welcome being asked to speak to your organization or group. Each week, we showcase vital women between the ages of 70 to 100 plus who shatter the myths that we become invisible as we age. These women lead fulfilling lives for themselves and others.
We are so pleased to be talking today with Elizabeth Zib Hintz from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Now, I was introduced to Zib by my sister Karen Marino. They share a passion for rowing. Prior to retiring from full-time work at age 70, Zib's career included working as an urban planner with a social work MSW background and as a policy analyst and program manager with the public school system. In the early 1970s, Zib traveled across Europe and the Middle East for a year, returned to visit the Middle East shortly before the Iranian Revolution, and much more travel since then. At age 42, Zib gave birth to her only child, a son, and after 4 decades of being with her life partner, Zib divorced what had become her special occasion husband. At age 65, Zib took up rowing, learned to play the cello, and now performs in a local orchestra and a quartet. I also want to mention that Zib was raised in small town America, the first born to a farm family living near a town with a population of 400. So during my Get Acquainted conversation with Zib, I heard some key themes that we're so interested in hearing more about. One is about her curiosity and risk, yet being pulled back to a safety anchor. Another has to do with Zib's attraction to large community visions and people creating change. And a third, her aspiration to live a life of endurance with grace. So welcome, Zib, to Women Over 70, Aging Reimagined. And we'd like to begin with the notion of following curiosity, engaging risk. And how did this come to be such a key theme in your life?
Well, thank you. I think it's because I've always considered myself a late bloomer. Being born in 1945 in a small farm country, this was just 1 year in advance of the baby boom. And I thought, coming from this small town area and just at the close of the war, Second World War, I thought I had to follow a script and be the nice girl, responsible, and certainly predictable, and really try to do things the best, be the best, be competitive. So that's how I started out. But I couldn't do it. And I slipped out of that script mode into an early divorce, and I began to follow my own interests. Kind of more of a track directed by my curiosity. And of course, that was risky and scary. This was in the late 60s and early 70s. But not allowing myself to explore as a young adult and develop my own being in my late teens has made me feel like I've been kind of catching up ever since. And that's not really so about catching up, but I've been curious about new things and in meeting new people and better understanding the world throughout my life. And I can't imagine not continuing that. The whole idea that some people have of a bucket list is just anathema to me, because that sounds so finite. And they will say, well, we keep adding to the list. But the fact is that it's something so specific, and I prefer to let my curiosity evolve, I guess. So
I'm sorry. I really would like to go back to the small community that you, I know you were raised on a farm and then moved to a somewhat larger community and a suburb of the Twin Cities. But how did you then make that break? Because what you did traveling across Europe and the Middle East in the early 70s seems pretty darn risky to me.
That was kind of risky. That was kind of crazy. But I just had to do it. So I just thinking of when I was born, my father was actually farming with horses. There were no there's no lights, no electricity or running water in this sweet little cottage farmhouse right on a bend of the Yellow Medicine River. And I remember that very, very distinctly. My parents, my mother was a school teacher, dad was a farmer, and then became a small business person. And we always had lots of books. And I was read to, all of us kids, the four of us were read to, and we read to each other. And I remember in particular a book that mom and dad had that were kind of sepia tone photographs of places in the ancient world. And I remember being very, very young, poring over that book. And somehow our family lost that book, but it's very distinct in my mind. So I guess some of those early beginnings overrode this notion that I had to follow a script when the script was making me very unhappy. But I wanted very much to go to the University of Minnesota. That was big time. And I did not want anything to do with some of the other post-secondary opportunities that were around. And also very few of the people in my high school graduating class were going on to post-secondary education. But this was 1963. But it was just expected in my family. Not really planned for, not really financially prepared for, but it was simply expected. And then it was easier somehow to pull all of that off. So I guess that was that laid the groundwork for making some of the breaks that I did.
And when you traveled to Europe and the Middle East, was that between undergraduate and graduate school or after graduate school?
No, that was a year after graduate school. Yeah, I put a Volkswagen Bug in storage with a friend and took all the money I had, which wasn't much, bought a backpack and went off. A $200 round trip flight on Sabena Airlines from New York to Brussels. That's what it took. And I had friends in three key areas of Europe. So I knew I had, you know, little safety landings in at least three places. I was an art history minor, and so I was very curious, you know, about the usual kinds of places, large urban areas. Didn't get to Berlin, but spent several weeks in Paris and Vienna, and went on because of a hitchhiking partner. I ended up going into the Middle East just because I had a partner, hitchhiking partner, that is, I want to emphasize. So.
Okay.
Yeah, right. And then another big goal that year was I really, really wanted to get up into the Arctic Circle. And I did do that. My partner, who I had left, we had broken up, came, met me in Parma, Italy. We were married. And we went off hitchhiking for the rest of the year together. And part of that was hiking up in Scandinavian, up above the Arctic Circle, crossing over from Finland to Sweden to Norway. So so that all high risk in the early fall. And then I really needed some safety anchors after that. So
So you returned to the Twin Cities then after?
Months later. We had spent the winter on a little island in Greece.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. But all that could have been done, it was done relatively easily. It can be very hard to do that now on almost no money.
So what about your return visits to the Middle East? What made that happen?
So again, it was just opportunity. I had one of my, one of the people that I had worked with, actually my boss, a kind of mentor at city planning department, was married to a woman from Iran, and we all became friends, and I became fascinated with that, much more interested in that part of the world, is fascinated with learning more about this, and was invited to come with her to visit for a couple of months. And so I did. I took a leave of absence from where I was working and went to Iran. This was in 76, and stayed in a city, Kermanshah, very near the Iraqi border. It's much, much different now. And then traveled on my own on a bus to other parts of Iran. Because it was there, and because I had a link, it wasn't just theoretical to me. And in many ways, that's how I've followed through with other, or developed other curiosities, because of knowing someone who is involved in something else that sounds interesting. And that just seems an easy bridge into that next subject to follow through.
Right, right. Yeah. I want to hear about your life partner of 42 or 41 years or something, but I was once just wondering, you were an urban planner with a social work background, you're a policy analyst, program manager in the public school systems. How important was that work to you? How central was that to what you were doing?
You know, that always was very hard for me. It represented such a dichotomy. Mm-hmm. I wanted very much to contribute, help to make a better community, a better world. And of course, I also wanted to follow my own interests. Mm-hmm. And I could never figure out how to do, in a sense, both at the same time, or follow my own interests and be gainfully employed. So doing the policy work and program management work was very fulfilling. It really made me stretch into uncomfortable areas of growth. But ultimately very beneficial. And I think I was very helpful, or my work was very helpful, in improving a public school system, or better responding to children's needs, families' needs, the community needs, in a sense. But developing more and more writing and speaking skills, and being able to withstand a barrage of anger in public meetings. That's all, you know, very character building. Mm-hmm. But and that's a certain kind of fulfillment. And I needed to do that to pay the mortgage, but even more importantly, to help raise my son. Mm-hmm. But the greater, I guess, deeper joy in many ways has been more physical work. More, it's not really work, it's almost play. More physical activities. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the farm background coming out, who knows. You know, the hiking and the biking, rowing, skiing, that kind of thing. And running for a while, quite a while. I was quite a serious runner.
Don't forget sailing.
Yes, that's right. Sailing was a very important phase of my life together with my husband. We had bought and then continued to work on a 35-foot double-ended sailboat, Ketch. That was a replica of a 19th century Norwegian pilot boat. And built for the North Sea. And we sailed it up and down the Atlantic in Chesapeake Bay, through Long Island, through New York City Harbor several times, and Long Island Sound. And then finally realizing that it needed more work than we could do with it on the East Coast, we brought it through the Erie Canal and the Great Lakes to Duluth. And all of that over two sailing seasons. That was quite thrilling. And then I became pregnant.
And, then you became pregnant.
Then I became pregnant. And then that changed everything. Life totally changed. And at the age of 42, I was not going to, I was not up for raising a child on a 35-foot catch and kind of making do for salary here and there. That wasn't going to work. So we moved quite emphatically into a bit more of a traditional life. Although we did bring the sailboat back to our, at great expense, brought it back to our backyard, and actually bought a house with a yard large enough to store it on jack stands while it could be worked on. So so we've, I've had a bit of a history with sailing, but I've very much deeply enjoyed all of that kind of physical activity. It's meant a great deal to me.
Have you continued to do this kind of physical activity? I'm not leaving and traveling, you know, for a year or so, but are you still very active physically?
Yes, I guess so. Catherine's sister thinks I am. Karen thinks I am. Yeah, the rowing. This year we're just sculling because we can only row in singles because of COVID. So it's much safer to be out there in a single. And I get great joy out of that. And I bike several times a week, you know, at some distances, and do a lot of fast hiking. And I have friends that do these things with me. And I've also got a new partner, a wonderful man who is an avid biker and walker. So that's really a joy, a great joy.
I lost my train of thought because I got so involved in managing all this activity.
It's all made sense. It all makes sense. I know it's a list, but it's all made sense.
I want to go back to your attraction, what you said, attraction to large community visions and people creating change. And as I recall from the conversation you and I had, your husband was someone who was very much about creating change. And I was, I was curious about how much that affected your life and to what extent you were involved in his visions, his work.
No, that shaped my adult life very greatly. Is at the time he and I kind of re-met each other and became involved with each other. It was, if all of you remember, 1969, 70, 71, 72, there was a lot of political activity. And my husband was a Vietnam veteran. My brother had just returned from 2 years in Vietnam in the Marines. And I knew a number of other Vietnam veterans. Anyway, my husband became the state coordinator for Vietnam Veterans Against the War and did amazing did amazing things doing that with in public, and I was just astonished. This was before I understood about guerrilla theater and strong public advocacy. I could see that other people were doing this, but for me to know someone who was doing this and changing people's minds and helping them think more deeply and then getting them to act, in terms of at least advocating for an end to the Vietnam War, that kind of thing, that was really life-changing. I was also living with someone who was helping to develop the Indian Education Act that was being created through Senator Edward Kennedy's office in Washington. And mm-hmm. between my roommate Liz and my husband, there I was surrounded by all this action, all this, you know, references to these people I was even hearing about on the 6 o'clock news. And I could see that individuals could make change happen. That was really astonishing to me and a great eye opener. I didn't act on this on my own immediately. I was supportive of both of them in doing these activities. But it wasn't until I was working within the school system that I was sort of called upon to step up in a very public way and advocate, you know, analyze situations, present logical conclusions, and advocate for them, essentially advocating for children, advocating for parents in the community. Although I didn't do this kind of thing on a national scene, except in regard to students mm-hmm. who are homeless, I took some leadership role in helping to develop some research regarding students who are homeless and highly mobile, and helping to write materials and do trainings, but all of this was much more on a local and regional level.
Mm-hmm. Well, and very impactful, it sounds.
Yes,
it sounds
yes.
Like.
Although we need infinitely more affordable housing than we have now, and equitable mm-hmm. Living conditions. So, but I guess one of the things that was brought that I understood was that if you knew something you needed, if you deeply, deeply understood something and knew it, you mm-hmm. had to say mm-hmm. it. You had to say it publicly mm-hmm. and you had to argue on behalf of others.
So it sounds like we can't see you, but it sounds like that was an incredibly meaningful experience for you to learn to do that.
Yeah.
And I understand.
Yes, girls from Yellow Medicine County are not taught to stand up and speak.
<That's right. laughs> I'm just putting myself in your place.
Chippewa County, I know.
That's like, yep, Chippewa mm-hmm. County, yep.
Yeah.
So you go from farm,
right.
No running water, et cetera, to
right.
standing up there
right.
and fighting mm-hmm. for people's rights. Mm-hmm.
Which any number of other people have done. So I am definitely not alone in that.
No, but it took great individual courage for you to do that and to step up into your own power and recognize that you could make a difference. And you did that.
Yes, and wish I could do more. What can we say? But I did in those roles as much as I could, and as much, let's say, I did much more than I ever thought I could ever do.
Mm-hmm. Good for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you retired at age 70.
Yeah, well, actually, I was 69.
So,
but that's okay.
Okay. So, what prompted that decision?
Let's see. I was tired, and I was not. Mm-hmm. I felt I was. I had stopped being able to make headway. Politically, I'm thinking within our state and our county, and not because I wasn't trying enough, but it just was not politically the right time for people to be able to act on, you know, developing more housing or a variety of things that children and families in our communities here desperately need. And it was time. I was beginning to attend committee meetings in which I could write the script. And, I've discovered since then that other people have had the same sensation in a way. You go to a meeting and you say, okay, I know what that person's going to say, and they've just said it, you know? So it was really time. It was time to go. And I was very concerned that my sense of being tired with the way we were going about doing things was going to end up reflecting on the issues that I was trying to address. And that could not happen. So I worked very hard at finding a very, very credible, strong replacement for myself. And thankfully, he was hired, and that worked. And that worked. Very, very, very good. Well received. Yes. So that's worked. Yeah.
Excellent. You know, when we talked, you said that you want to live a life of endurance with grace. I love that. And I want to know
what
that means.
Well, I hope
that
doesn't sound like I'm exhausted and just exhausted with a smile on my face. That's not at all what I mean. I meant much more that I am more of an endurance person. I'm not your slalom skier. I'm not a whitewater rafter. I prefer to move more slowly, especially in uncharted waters, and yet keep moving, keep progressing. So what that means, I guess, is that how do you keep moving through life with as much grace as you possibly can muster, given what comes your way. And COVID is throwing all of us for some loops. And it's like every day we can easily have an existential moment or two. And how do you do all that with grace?
That's lovely.
Yes. And I'm wondering, do you have any answers for us?
Learn to play the cello.
That helps. Some people would say yoga, which is very, very good, of course. But I learned to play cello, and if I can just lose myself in that. And again, cello and all musical activity is really physical. And cello is definitely, it's like a whole body experience. So it's very tiring, because it is so physical, but it is a very beautiful thing to lose yourself in that moment of making a sound that you are striving for, and combinations of sound. That is very beautiful to me.
Was there a reason that you chose the cello?
Only because I'd always wanted to play the cello ever since I realized what it was. As a child, I didn't, you know, I had never heard of a cello or seen one or even seen a picture of one. So at some point, maybe in late teens or early adulthood, I began to realize what it was. It's always called me. Mm-hmm. I asked a friend who worked at a string store one day when I was in real deep doldrums what it would take to learn to play the cello. I was thinking she would say something like, well, a check for $5,000 or $10,000. And she said, $50 a month. That's all you need. You rent it. You rent it by the month. That's all you need. And so I was out there that week.
And now you play in the local orchestra and
a cello quartet. Mm-hmm.
I love the cello.
Oh, lovely.
Many people do because they say the sound is so much like the human voice that it's a comfort. Mm-hmm. It's a comfort, and I love the range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it's easy on my ears. whereas actually higher pitch instruments are very, very hard for my ears. And as a person is older, that is much more the case.
Interesting. You're 75. Yes. You're obviously still, you are a model for endurance with grace from what we hear from you. So how do you think about aging? And if
well,
so, how do you think about
it? I do sometimes, not often, because, again, I prefer to live like right now. And it's not like I planned where I'm going to live next or where I'm ultimately going to live just before the end. I really don't care to think that way. I don't want to invest my psychic and intellectual energy in that direction. I've got a sweet little house on the banks of the Mississippi River on the bluff, and not on the banks, no. I guess it's right really on the bluff. And I've done things in the house that make it a safer place to be. I think it's very important for me to be as physically active and intellectually as active as I can be. For as long as I can be. And I'm not sure what that means, except that I'm always open to making new friends. I'm open to trying something new. I'm hoping that will stand me in good stead going forward over these next years. And of course, staying healthy, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It sounds like a very optimistic and fulfilling life course for someone who, I think you said to me, I don't really plan. You make things happen, though.
I would rather make things happen than over-plan. How's that? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And a little serendipity in things is a good thing.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you, Zib, so much for joining us today. It's been delightful talking with you, and we appreciate your candor and talking about some of your really fascinating life experiences. So
you're
thanks
welcome.
So much.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks so much, Zib. And listeners, please leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Become an active participant in our community through the Facebook group and our monthly Zoom gatherings. And we will see you next Wednesday on Women Over 70, Aging Reimagined.
Thank you for listening to Women Over 70, Aging Reimagined. If you like what you've heard today, please subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen. In what ways are you shattering the myth that women over 70 are no longer relevant or visible? How are you celebrating aging? Join with us. Make your voice heard. Find us at womenover70.com.